The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on December 5, 2008. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. I thought for today and tomorrow I would just read from this book, The Zen Teachings of Wang Po, one of my favorites. One that I'm sure most of you are familiar with. If you're not, I highly recommend it. It's still around. This has the price tag of $1.95 on it. So it was some time ago. Though I didn't buy it. I was at a party one night many years ago as a young guy. Standing by a bookshelf, and I just happened to look at the shelf, and I was very much interested in Zen in those days, and I just saw it. So I pulled it. I was looking at it when the hostess came by, and she said, "Do you like that book?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "You can have it." So anyway, that's how I found Wang Po. And I was very much taken by it early on. And I've commented from it here and there from time to time. But I thought it would be good just to sit down and spend a little bit of time with it at this Sesshin. And who knows, maybe this will be a theme for a while at Sesshins. I don't know. But we'll see how much we can get. I'm certainly not going to go through the whole book, but there are many passages in here worth taking some time with. And this first one, I have talked on many times actually before, at least a portion of it, or at least I've used it in various talks. But I don't know that I've actually just sat down with the piece itself and just spoke from that directly. So that's what I'll do now. And probably today, this is from the Chung Chau record, and that's probably, I don't know how much of this we're going to do today, but I certainly won't go beyond that. Chung Chau record of the Zen master Wang Po, or Tuan Chi. Well, let me just read. "All the Buddhas and all sentient beings are nothing but the one mind, beside which nothing exists. This mind, which is without beginning, is unborn and indestructible. It is not green nor yellow, and has neither form nor appearance. It does not belong to the categories of things which exist or do not exist, nor can it be thought of in terms of new or old. It is neither long nor short, big nor small, for it transcends all limits, measures, names, traces, and comparisons. It is that which you see before you. Begin to reason about it, and you at once fall into error. It is like the boundless void, which cannot be fathomed or measured. The one mind alone is the Buddha, and there is no distinction between the Buddhas and sentient beings, but that sentient beings are attached to forms, and so seek externally for Buddhahood. By their very seeking, they lose it, for that is using the Buddha to seek for the Buddha, and using mind to grasp mind. Even though they do their utmost for a full eon, they will not be able to attain it. They do not know that if they put a stop to conceptual thought and forget their anxiety, the Buddha will appear before them. For this mind is the Buddha, and the Buddha is all sentient beings. It is not the less for being manifested in ordinary beings, nor is it greater for being manifested in the Buddhas." Okay, that was quite a mouthful there. So Wang Po, he said, "All Buddhas and all sentient beings are nothing but the one mind, beside which nothing exists." I have to say a little bit about some of the terms used in this translation, something I certainly didn't appreciate when I first encountered this. But now, after all these years and getting more acquainted with these teachings, I don't have the Chinese for this. I wish I did, because I'd like to check on some of these terms. Like this term "exist," that really isn't what Wang Po is using here. Of course, we don't really have a word for what it is that he is talking about, but "exist," because he says right on here, it doesn't belong to categories of things that exist or do not exist. And so why compare it to things which do not exist? It's our language. Like I said, I don't know exactly what term that was used in the Chinese, but I think even there in Chinese you're still going to have some trouble with this. It is our very in our very conceptualizing that we, well, are carrying on with this assumption of existence. And our language is constructed out of that. And in fact, our language, not our language, not just English, but just language alone, is certainly, it's conceptual, and therefore it is to put things back into packages, into forms, into constructed things. Well, this is a problem. This is a problem particularly when it comes to Dharma teaching, when what it is that we're pointing to, what is being pointed out, isn't something like that at all, which is what Wang Po is pointing to here, saying that it doesn't belong to categories of things such as existence and non-existence. And what is that again? What are we talking about? We are talking about reality. Here he says mind, he talks about the one mind. He also says that this is Buddha, or the Buddhas. And this one mind is nothing but the Buddhas and sentient beings. And sentient beings are in no way to be distinguished from Buddhas, except perhaps in one way, which isn't really even such a distinction, because sentient beings themselves are Buddhas. So what exactly are we talking about? Our categorizing mind, our conceptualizing mind, our grasping mind is going to be boxing everything up, putting boundaries between things and putting labels on things, which now makes it very useful, handy, easy for us to talk about things and manipulate things and show relationships between things and all of that. But when what it is that we're after here is to wake up to see reality, and when those who have done this, those who directly see reality, consistently use language in such a way to point out that we actually can't capture this in words, in language, well, it creates a real problem. But then what kind of language, what kind of words can we employ? What can we use here? They're always going to be a problem. Dogen speaks of traps and snares everywhere. A lot of this has to do with just simply through our thinking, through using language, through using words. When we speak, even though we might be speaking in a way that is pointing to a direct experience, it always is offering some conceptual construct there of some sort. If we start just babbling, you know, sounds, you know, and that sort of thing, well, even there in the babbling of the sound, we're still speaking the truth, but it isn't particularly helpful for people. So we say things that might steer people in various ways to direct their attention a bit, but there's that strong tendency then to grasp the word or what is being spoken and to think that somehow that what the awakened are pointing out to us is an idea or something that we can think about or something that we need to seek out, to find and to grasp and to own and possess. If in no other way than just simply through understanding of a concept, an idea. Okay, but what Wang Po is speaking of here then in terms of reality, this one mind is of this nature that we really can't speak of it directly. And that whatever we do in terms of speaking of it, we immediately fall into error. So he says, all Buddhas and all sentient beings. All Buddhas, all sentient beings. Now, what has he left out here? Strictly speaking, he hasn't really left out anything. So all Buddhas, all sentient beings, he said, are nothing but the one mind, beside which nothing exists. Does this mean then that the mind exists, this one mind exists? Does it mean Buddhas exist? Does it mean sentient beings exist? No, it does not. And this has to be understood, that we have the appearance of existence. Sentient beings appear to exist. Buddhas appear to to exist. But what we have is this one mind. This is reality. It is called mind because it gives appearance. It is called mind because whatever is experienced is of that nature. It is of a mental nature. It is manifested, whatever it is, you know, appearing here in mind is manifested as sound and color and touch and taste and thought and feeling. This is mind. And what Wang Po is saying, that this is just this one mind. Why is it called one? Capital O, capital M, one mind. Why is it called one? He says, besides which nothing else exists. Now that implies then that maybe here's our limitation of language, in that this one mind exists, but it doesn't exist. Then we naturally think, because we are conceptualizing beings, because we package up and grasp our experience, then we say, if this one mind doesn't exist or it does not exist, well, then we think, well, there's our language. I just said it there. It does not exist. Well, we can't say that it does not exist. Our language doesn't go there. And I've looked at this for many years now, how to speak of this, to find this third category. It's actually called the middle way, because that's what the Buddhist teaching is really all about, is to avoid these extremes of existence and non-existence. But our language is such that if we say it's not that, we immediately go over here. Our conceptualizing goes with that way. Our thinking always brings us from one extreme to the other. And even if we were, this is what I've learned, even if we were to try to find some other kind of category there, you know, to place words, that we have existence, we have, it's not two, it's not existence, non-existence, is there's a third one we can put in there. And you put some kind of word on that. But our mind is still going to throw that over into the category of exist or not exist. What would we say? It doesn't exist because we just made it up. That's what our mind will do. The mind will always pull things over to one extreme or the other. And when we believe that, when we think that somehow reality is that way, we are deluded. We are confused because it is an illusion. Reality is not that way. It just looks that way, sounds that way. Our thinking about it constructs it in that way. And that appearance is pretty definite and solid, and it works in concert with all the various senses at the same time. So you not only can feel the floor, you can see it, you can hear it if you rap on it. It all works together. And it's a very convincing illusion. Now, at the same time, we have to understand, because we say that this isn't existence, we also have to understand then, because our mind will think, and then somehow we're talking about, well, that there's not existence here, like we, as if this was nothing. But clearly this is not nothing. The sound, the touch, the taste, the thought, the feeling. It isn't at either of these extremes. And this is the one mind. Besides this, being this way, being, there we go, wrong word. And this way, but language forces, so forgive me, I have to use language here. But you have to look beyond just the language and get into what this is pointing out for us about actual experience, as we actually experience this. This is called, Wang Po now very dangerously puts this title on it, one mind. It is mind because the experience of it is, what else are you going to call it? It is mental. For lack of a better word, we got to put some word, let's put that on. Because as we normally think of mind, boy, we're right there with it. It's just that we think of my mind, your mind, that sort of thing. That isn't what is being directly experienced. It is just this. And it is mind. And it is one mind. Capital O, one. Not because it is one of many, or one other than two. It is one because, well, as he says, besides which, there's just, well, we can speak of nonsense. Nothing else. This is it. This way that we experience it directly is it. There you are. We can't grasp it because it doesn't really manifest actually as something. It just has that appearance of somethingness. But because we always assume and believe and trust somethingness, then when we say, well, it isn't really something, then immediately watch our mind. Now we're thinking that somehow we're talking about nothingness, as if we can dismiss this. Well, we can't dismiss. I mean, here it is. We can't dismiss this. What are we talking? We are talking about the true nature of reality. What is it? And it is like this. We cannot grasp it. We cannot throw it away. We cannot dismiss it. It is mind. This is the one mind. So he says that all Buddhas, those who are awake, now of course everything we say, those who are those, well, we never find those, but they are called Buddhas. And sentient being, well, who are those? Maybe for a long time we've identified as one of those. Yeah, I'm one of those. Maybe even identify as Buddha. I'm one of those. But it is never, because that's to throw it into somethinghood, and we can't go there. It just is, if we are awake, we realize that. We don't think in those terms. We might temporarily use that because it's handy in talking about people in ordinary parlance when you go to the grocery store or whatever. But we don't have to, you know, it's very helpful and useful, but we don't have to make the mistake of thinking that somehow this is how things actually are. They're that way well enough. They appear that way. So let's get on with it then, if that's how they appear. But let's not lose sight of the true reality that's behind this. Because were we to keep touch with that, our behavior and the way we'll live, all of this will unfold in a radically different way. And this is our chance for freedom, being free of dukkha and pain and suffering and confusion. So all Buddhas, all sentient beings, they are this. There's nothing but this. It's just this. This is reality. It is just as I've been pointing out here now. And I can't exactly say how it is because that would be to package it up once again into something particular, which it is not. But it has this appearance of looking like this, sounding like this, feeling like this, whatever it is happening. This is it. Okay, he said this mind, which is without beginning, is unborn and indestructible. This mind, which is without beginning, okay, this mind is without beginning. Well, how do we know that? Well, all you have to do is just look. Do you see a beginning anywhere? Can you imagine a beginning? Can you construct a beginning? I don't think you can. I mean, even if we were to say, well, some supernatural being got it going, well, how convincing is that? And have we really gotten to the beginning anyway? What about that supernatural being? You can't conceive of, you cannot construct, you cannot put together a beginning. You say, well, what about the Big Bang? Well, I'm sorry, there's problems with the Big Bang. The Big Bang is beginning to show some wear these days too, by the way. We can have a constructed beginning. Well, God started it, or the Big Bang started this, or whatever. But you can't get hold of that thing. There's all kinds of problems when you try to get back to that starting point. As the Buddha said long ago, we don't find the anterior extremity. We just don't find the extremity that goes before, that began it all, that started it all. Of course, sometimes here we talk about source, but that's a little different in a sense. But that's a problem, another problem term. There's another problem term here, void. There's a lot of problem terms here, traps and snares everywhere. Again, I didn't appreciate this when I first read this. And I would use terms in kind of an ordinary way, not realizing these terms are actually pointing to something that you better not try to pin this down. As we talk about this, as we think about this, as we go over this, watch your grasping mind trying to nail that one and grasp. That's not the exercise here. That's our usual exercise. That's how we'll usually take it up. And if you continue to do that, as Wang Po says all over the place in this book, you will remain entrapped and entangled. And, you know, you can practice this way for eons and never get anywhere. So this isn't about that. So what are we doing then as we go over this? You know, rather than trying to grasp it and get a hold of it and form ideas of it and think, oh, that's... Realize this experience right here, right now. You know, it's here and a little bit, is that which is right before you, right now. And it's not before, there's another problem word. Well, all these words are problem. You have problem word. It's always going to be, can you see how that's a problem word? But we have to say something. If we don't use these words, then why don't we use some other word? Well, what words are you going to use? I've been working on this and mulling these things over and trying to find ways to express this for 30 years now. What words are you going to use? Help me out. We got to use words like this, but we have to watch out, so we have to be warned. You're going to use words like this, or words like something. Every word is going to, you know, have something there that you can grab hold of. You're never going to say it right. But as we work this through, as we go over this, and so this isn't about grasping and getting the idea. This is about just notice something's being pointed out about actual experience, immediate experience. What is right before you, or without the word before, just this. This is what we're pointing at. And then he says to reason about it. Well, I'm getting ahead here on the piece. But then he says, you immediately fall into error. Yeah, so he warns of this over and over again. But I'm getting ahead there a little bit. But this mind, it is without beginning, unborn, indestructible. So this, a moment ago I was talking about it as if we're talking about the universe or something like that, the whole thing. But you don't have to even look at it that way. Just look at it even as your own personal direct experience. Where do you find the beginning of that? Do we imagine that maybe somewhere in the womb, suddenly, poof, my consciousness just appeared here or something, or did it happen after birth? When did that happen? Was there such a time? We can sit there and imagine this and speculate on it. Some people will speculate on whether there is any consciousness in the womb, and other people will testify, oh yes, because they know directly that consciousness is there. Now, people have memories of that. Other people say, oh no, you can't remember that far back. But I don't know. I don't know about that. I used to be very skeptical of such things. But the fact is, whether we stop there, we go back, now we can begin to speculate past lives and saying, but the whole past is an illusion. You, right now, are an illusion. When did you begin? You want to arbitrarily make up some point there, but it's all an illusion. There's just right now this right here. This isn't an illusion, except it manifests nothing but illusion. It shows everything to be illusory. Why is that? Because everything that is showing up here cannot actually be gotten hold of. And when did it begin? Well, it doesn't really show. And even though you can arbitrarily put these points way back there in time somewhere, that's just an idea, a belief, a constructed thing, something you're making up now. The fact is, you don't need to put something there. What the Buddha was concerned with is not to discuss these things. He wouldn't talk about these questions. When did the universe begin? Did it begin? Oh, you know, he had those 16 questions he just wasn't going to bother with. Kind of a waste of time. There's nothing really there to discuss, other than maybe we can discuss this in such a way to help us realize that, you know, that... That's going nowhere. This is right here. This is why it's called the middle way once again, too. We don't deal with that extreme, the past or the future. Where is this heading toward? The omega point, what's that? Where are we going? And we can speculate and speculate all we want, but if we want to wake up, waking up is right here, right now. What is this? We don't go to these extremes. the Buddha gave us a teaching by the middle, which is just to be here, present here, and to wake up to this and to realize what this experience is. And when we do, if we can arrive at this, well, you're not going to have any more concern for those kinds of questions. I mean, they're kind of interesting, fascinating. We can talk about them, that sort of thing. But really, in the end, they're flat earth questions. I think you all know what I mean by that. The person who believes the earth is flat, you're going to have all these questions. But one who understands the earth is a sphere, these aren't questions. These aren't real questions. They're not valid questions. And so it is for us, if we were to wake up to what this is here, those kinds of questions drop away just as surely as you're walking the beach with somebody from the Dark Ages and they have all these questions and they can't quite understand. But you understand perfectly well what their concerns are. Does it go on forever? Does it have an edge? You understand it's not a real question. You're going to have a hard time helping them out of their confusion, however, because they're so deep into it. But little by little, you can probably help them out. That's the situation we're in, most of us. Because we, like the flat earth, who framed it up in his mind in the wrong way, he's got the wrong picture of what's going on here. Now he's got all these questions that mean absolutely nothing other than they seem to have meaning for him. We're doing the same thing. Because we've wrapped this up, we're confused about this matter of existence, about something and nothing, about mind, about what is actually being experienced, about self, about beginnings and ends, about time, space. We're so deep in this confusion, and not just you alone, the whole society, all of humankind for the most part, except for those who wake up, really lost in this profound confusion. And out of that, we labor and work and work in all kinds of ways that are very painful and destructive for us. So, of course, other ways that are helpful and useful too. But we pollute the rivers and the streams and we make our weapons of mass destruction. And where are we heading with all of this? But I'll tell you, all of this doing that we're doing in this regard is coming directly out of minds that are confused in just this way. This is a serious problem. It's serious enough for us as a species to wipe ourselves out. Not that cosmically that makes any difference. As Sawaki Roshi says, the bomb can go off right on the top of your head and your true nature won't be destroyed. So in the end, you don't really need... But must we continue to labor in such painful and needless confusion? Or can we wake up? That's what these teachings are. This is what this practice is. It is about finally seeing at long last what is going on here. And to wake up from this profound confusion that we have, this constructed reality that we make, and thinking then that it is real. And then all these questions that we have about it. And about myself, and after I die, and what is it, you know. Where are you going to go? People believe this, people believe that. People believe, well, that's it. When I die, that's it. It's all over. Done. Well, that's fine, but it is a belief. Do you know? Well, if you were to make your mind very quiet, you would know. You would know that that's not a valid question. It has nothing to do with reality, with the way things are. And that can be seen immediately and directly and right now. Were we to make our mind very quiet and pay very careful attention to what is going on here. And this is what Wang Po, going back this now, just in the last few days, I reread the whole book here, and this is what he's doing over and over again, out of a deep compassion to help us out of our confusion. This is without beginning, unborn and indestructible. That's it, bomb going off over your head. Yeah, it's indestructible. Your true nature is indestructible. Because of whatever I'm saying about the world or the universe or the one mind, it's the same thing I'm talking about you. Of course, I'm not talking about you, your little but that's what you really are. You understand? Were we to see this in this way, it isn't all splintered out like that. Well, there's me, and then here's the world, and if the world blew up, well, I guess I'd be in trouble. As if somehow the world were something different from you, and what happens to that out there now might affect me, and that's how we'll see it. Instead of realizing there's just one mind, it's just this one, I'm going to say thing, but of course it's not a thing. There's just this reality, and it is indestructible. But if we don't understand its nature, it is known as dukkha, that is suffering, it is pain, and we will carry on in ways that are ultimately painful and destructive. But we can wake up from it, and we can wake up from it, and we will wake up from it in a flash, in an instant. And he talks about, you know, doing things in stages here. That's that's what people think when we're caught up in the world of this and that. There are no stages. Dogen speaks of this too. Still, there is this thing that appears to be gradual, sure. But ultimately, we can't say stages. But there's one mind, it's unborn and indestructible. Here in the footnote, John Blofeld says about this term unborn, he says it is not in the sense of eternity, for this allows contrast with its opposite, which I guess would be temporality. I don't know, what would that be? Time. But unborn in the sense that it belongs to no categories admitting of alternation or antithesis. Yeah, unborn in that way. Though I'm not convinced that's how it's being used here, but that is true, however, what he's saying. That he's not talking about something that would admit to categories of alternation or antithesis, that sort of thing. There's nothing else. That's the one mind again. One because there's nothing else. It's not one as opposed to many. It's one without an other. One without an outside. One, like, you know, need an image. I think of that image of King Chaos. You remember King Chaos? You know, he doesn't have any senses, you know, no openings for the eyes and the ears, etc. And so there's nothing outside of chaos, in a sense. Which is amazing for an ancient image, a Taoist image of chaos, because we know from modern mathematics that that's what chaos always has to do with. It has to do with totality. It has to do with, at least with wholeness within systems, but really, in the end, totality, the whole itself. But that's another issue. But nothing but the one mind besides which, and this mind is without beginning, it's indestructible, and it is not green nor yellow. Now, what is he talking about there? Not green or yellow. It doesn't have qualities. It is undifferentiated. It won't be distinguished from other kinds of things. Well, here's things that are green, has this characteristic of green. Other things that are yellow, it has a characteristic of yellow. Or then we could say red or other colors as well. Or even other kinds of qualities. Here's the quality of colors. Here's the quality of shapes. These are still, to some degree, visual kinds of distinctions, but then we can go on with that and make more. But it just doesn't belong to categories and cannot be characterized in some particular way. If we think of different colors, some being hot and some being cool, it doesn't apply to this. Not something physical. And the Buddha described physical or the body as something that can get wet. This is not something that can get wet. Though wetness and sound and color and shape and all of these things are manifested. As Tozan says, you know, you are not it, it actually is you. Okay, so it actually is showing up as everything that is appearing here, that is manifesting here. But you take hold of any one of these things, any one of these characteristics or qualities or actual objects, they are not it. It shows up as this. Of course, it is not it either. Again, problem word there. Because it's not a thing. Again, what are we talking about? Let's crawl back into this again. What are we talking about? We talk about this reality as if it were some particular thing. And our language forces it in. We're even using the term it there now. Even Tozan is using the word it. Because our language will force us into that again. We have to be aware of what's going on there when this is happening. And our mind will be following in that, and we won't know there's a problem with this. And of course, then we might say, well, then can't we say it in some other way? Well, I defy you to find some other way to say that. Well, of course, I mean, we can always say it in other ways, but you're still going to have the same problem. We have to see beyond that. And what are we talking about looking at? Looking at immediate experience. And realizing that you're not going to capture it in words. Immediate experience, and I say you're not going to capture it. Here we go again. Language. So language is useful. It's wonderful. I earn my livelihood with it. But it is limited. It cannot capture reality. For that, and that's what we're taught. That's what all of this practice and teaching is about, is to help us come back to and notice just this. that language can't actually point out. So it's not green, not yellow, and it has neither form nor appearance. It doesn't have, reality itself. Well, what does it look like? Well, we could say it looks like this, but it never holds still. You ever notice this doesn't stop? I mean, it's just in the next instant, it looks different. Of course, instances that appear to be very close together usually looks pretty similar from moment to moment. But nothing is holding still. And it doesn't have any particular appearance or form. But all form and all appearances, the Buddhas and sentient beings, as he says at the beginning, they're nothing but this, it's just reality itself, continuously showing itself in this way. How is it that it's formed? Well, now we can begin to understand mind, one of these aspects of mind. This is called mind. One of these aspects of mind is this matter of consciousness. Okay, this gives us a clue as to how consciousness fits into this picture. But we won't go there right now. But it is not green, not yellow, and has neither form nor appearance. It does not belong to the categories of things which exist or do not exist. Well, we've already talked about this a bit, but this matter of existence then. Again, what are we talking about? We talk about existence, we're talking about persistence. The easiest way to keep track of what it is that we're speaking of when we speak of existence is just think of persistence, something that is persisting from moment to moment. And this doesn't belong to that category. There's nothing about this that's... Well, I guess we could say that it is always like this. But that's not a thing, you see. But that is the true self, or the one self, or the big mind. That's why it goes by all these different names, and it is always thus. It is always this. But in terms of anything as manifesting, none of it is holding still whatsoever. So what is it that is always thus? Well, it always appears just like this, that we can't get hold of it, and here it is. It's always thus. But that in itself doesn't have form or appearance, and nor does it have existence. It is kind of the generator, whatever you say is wrong, of the appearance of existence, we could say. Because as things manifest, now we seem like we have existence. That's where we get the idea of existence. But we make the mistake that there's something in these appearances that persists, such as myself. And yet if we look very carefully, we will discover that we can't point to anything within this experience that is persisting. That still looks like itself in the end. The only thing that does is, just this, but that doesn't really have any actual appearance. And it really isn't anything there to exist as such. So it is really beyond existence. And also non-existence. For the simple fact that it would take quite an argument that this is nothing or non-existence. Because when we think of existence, then we think of that in terms of somethinghood. So we have some entity there, we have some endurance, some beingness, some thingness there. And then we contrast that with, its opposite, which would be then nothing. If we don't have something here, then we must have nothing. But the simple test of that is, just look clearly, this is not nothing. Sometimes we'll take the different things, and then attribute nothingness to them. Well, that they're trivial or they're nothing. Or we make up something, a unicorn. We make up some image in our mind and we'll say that that's really nothing because it doesn't exist. But you just created something there that surely exists in the sense that you've formed a thing. It gives the appearance of existence, even though we say it is nothing. So it appears like a something. It's the idea of a unicorn. And whatever it is that we also might be trying to dismiss as nothing, if we look very carefully, we're always talking about something. We're always talking about some formed thing or the appearance of something here. So that's what we have. We have appearance, but the appearance never holds still. So there's nothing within the appearance that is existing as such. But it is not non-existence. Or nothingness. It is not somethingness. It is not nothingness. That is our experience. So, and what are we talking about now? We are talking about reality. It is like this. And it is always like this. But then isn't that something persisting? Well, it never manifests as any particular form or appearance. So how can we call that existence? It is beyond, I guess we could say, though beyond isn't a very good word either, another problem word there. But it is beyond these categories, transcends these categories, as I've seen in one of the translations here. But it doesn't belong to the categories of things which exist or non-exist, nor can it be thought of in terms of new or old. You know, new or old, how old would this be? Well, if we can't find a beginning, if there's no discernible beginning, how do we find old or new? Something just recently formed, something fresh. If we actually can't pin this down in any kind of time, how long has it been? In Xinqingming, he says that a moment and an eon are one. When we are looking at this in terms of wholeness and in terms of totality, these kinds of distinctions completely disappear. So one of these days I'm going to give a talk on this, right? This winter now, in a couple of weeks, I'll be giving a talk on physics, philosophy, and prajna. I was thinking I want to do another one on math, motion, and mind. I can diagram this for you. Just enough interest in that one on physics. I might try this one some other time, but I'd love to do this sometime. I wish I could do it now. But it just shows that if we're in an infinite system, you know, or one where we can't find a discernible beginning or a discernible end, then this whole matter of time and duration and length and old and young and all of this sort of thing becomes meaningless. In the same way that the flat earthers' questions become meaningless. And that is what these ancients are speaking of here. You can't show any kind of progression. I mean, say that you're going to, you know, start out on an infinite path. So, I mean, here you are now and you're going to walk this infinite. How long does this path go? It goes on for infinity. So you start walking. How long is it going to take you then to get to some given point out there? Well, you actually can't get there. Not if you're going to cross all of the different points, because there's an infinite number of them. This is a problem that Zeno pointed out in mathematics, not just modern mathematics, but they sort of got past that one. Well, I finally realized how they got past it, and I bought it too for many years, and now I realize there's a flaw in it. And there's some other flaws in the reasoning that with their... In their thinking there too, because we don't understand the nature of consciousness. But the fact is that if you have an infinite path there, you can walk as long as you want, and you don't get anywhere on the path, so to speak. So in terms of, you know, being old or young, it really doesn't make any difference. We say how old is the universe? Well, I believe the galaxies that are furthest out that we could see are over 10 billion light years away. That means that the light from these galaxies has been traveling for over 10 billion years to get to where we can see it here now. And so it would seem like that's a long way away. It would seem like that was a long time ago. But we also know that you take a look at this photon that just showed up from that distant galaxy 10 billion light years away. And you ask that photon, well, how long did it take you to get from that galaxy to here? And the photon would say, just left. I mean, it just didn't take any time at all. And who's to say then, in the overall picture, since we're concerned with reality here, who's to say that your time frame is the correct one and the photon's time frame is wrong? That's just one way. There's many ways of looking at this. But these ancients realized this. It doesn't belong to categories of new... That this whole idea of new or old, young or old, or duration, these are meaningless. They understood the flat earther's concern here with this, and they point this out, that this is a meaningless question, a meaningless concern. It's functional and useful for us getting around in our everyday world to have ideas like this. Nothing wrong with that. But we make the mistake of thinking that somehow this is the way reality is. It just simply isn't that way at all. And there are other ways, I'm not going to take time now, too, where we can bring this down to just a small, so we don't have to be talking about galaxies 10 billion light years out there. We can be talking about things right here in this room, and you get the same kind of effects. But it would take me too long to set that up for you. the point I want to make here is that we are talking about reality. We're talking about this one mind. It doesn't belong to these categories that are old or young or whatever. And these are guys like Wang Po and others way back, long before they had modern math and physics to help them out with this stuff. They saw this. Because were we to see actual experience, you would know these things. So whatever it is that we're going to discover by looking at the world very carefully through our physics and our mathematics or whatever, you're not going to discover anything that would be of any kind of shock or surprise. You might discover things that weren't noticed, but once they come to light, if it's correct, they would not. Other things do come up and they're not right, and you can spot that too, such as the Big Bang. But what I'm saying here, though, is by very carefully looking at our experience here, you can realize the whole of it, all of it, and what it is, and how things are manifesting, therefore what kind of things you might dream up that could manifest. Well, they can only manifest in terms of your imagination. But we can see this, we can know this. These ancient guys saw this, and they knew this, and they could see it. You can too. Were we to just really look very carefully at our experience right here. It is neither long nor short, big nor small. Okay, I've probably said enough about that. For it transcends all limits, measures, names, traces, and comparisons. Okay, so that is what we're... And that's why we really can't talk about it. It in quotes. Because it transcends all of this, all names, traces, comparisons. So we can't talk about it. We can't form ideas of it. This is why it is never taught. I mean, believe me, if I could tell you, I would. You know, if there's something I could just hand over to you, I would, you know. It is just simply what we need to see directly for ourselves. Never mind the problem with that term, ourselves. It is something that needs to be seen directly, and it can. In fact, you do see it even now, as he's about to say here in a minute. It is what is right before you. No matter where your gaze falls, you are always looking at reality, giving you full information of what it is you need. Well, it's not even information. But everything that is necessary for you to realize your ultimate nature, ultimate reality. I say you because you are nothing but this one mind. And it isn't you, you understand. But it transcends all limits, measures, name, traces, comparisons, all of that then that we would use to talk about, to draw diagrams of, or to, you know, and like a moment ago I said, I wish I could, in one of these times, if I did a thing on math, I would diagram something, but it's really quite neat, actually. But I'm not diagramming something to show you how it is, because you can't diagram that. You can't diagram reality. What we can do is like what Nagarjuna does over and over again. He shows us what's erroneous in our thinking. If we think that such and such is true, he'll show you how that, on the face of it, using its own terms, is self-contradictory right there. And we can do the same kind of thing here. I could show you where if you had an infinite line, you can't make any progress on it. That can be demonstrated. I can show you that. But can I show you how it actually is? No, but it's just that it is of this nature that the kind of stuff that we do construct here and that we hang on to is not it. That's what we can show. We can show it in these negative terms. It is not this, it is not this, it is not this. Whatever you're going to put up there, that is not this. That's why I can't put something up for you. That's why Nagarjuna, in the end, we take that course in Nagarjuna and people want to know, well, what's this about? Well, he isn't really going to set something up there now for you. This is what we need to understand. Our strong desire to get something there that we can get hold of, and the fact that you can't, that's telling you something about reality. It's telling you directly something about the nature of just this. And there isn't something there for you to figure out or to grasp or to get an idea of now, but just to notice that it is always like that. And so then what does it mean in terms of how we're, you know, conducting our life and living our life, or how we're abusing the world? But it transcends all names, traces, comparison, and then he says, it is that which you see before you. And then he says, begin to reason about it, and you at once, in that very instant, you begin to reason about it, you begin to think about it, you begin to try to take hold of something. You fall into error. But that is what we do. We instantly When we're presented with something, we package it up in some way. If we give it any attention at all, that's where we'll go with it. We'll form ideas, theories, concepts, explanations for things. And every single one of them can be diagrammed and shown to be error, contradictory. Every one. Nagarjuna shows us this. It is impossible to construct something that isn't on the face of it self-contradictory. Doesn't match reality. Reality cannot be of this nature, no matter what construction you want to put there, what idea you have about it. It is not of this nature. And that, because we still want to get hold of it, though, and then we're in a quandary, we keep reaching because we don't still quite understand what's been shown here. And we don't understand that what you need to do at this point is just notice it's of that nature. You can't do that. It's very simple. That's one half. That's the one half. The other half is that it would be fortunate if this can happen very quickly. You realize that here it is. You can't get hold of it. Is it nothing? No, here it is. It's not nothing. Here it is. It's not something, whatever constructed thing you want. It's not that. Here, this is it. You have a gut understanding of that, a direct realization of that. This is what we're always talking about here. This is what is always being pointed out to us. This is what Wang Po is just working with in all these amazing ways in his book here, constantly bringing us back to this. This is what Nagarjuna points out for us. This comes right out of the very insight of the Buddha in realizing that we don't find this self here. We don't find entityhood. We don't find somethingness. Nor is this nothing. So it is that which you see directly before you now. This is constantly what is being shown and demonstrated. Manifested in such a way that there's nothing behind the manifestation. But there is this manifesting, and that is real. Real enough. It is showing us what is known as this relative reality. What is it really? Well, behind it, its backing is its actual reality. It's like this. But it's no particular way. We can't get hold of it. But it is always thus. This is what these masters are constantly pointing out. There's nothing to say about the moment you begin to reason about it. Took me years to figure out how to even keep talking at this point. Because whatever you say is not it. You know, but still, as my teacher, we've got to say something. So, but we can keep talking and pointing this out. But we can't say it. It is just what is seen right now. It is what is felt, experienced. But if we say something about it as if somehow we're going to describe it, we can point out where we go wrong. That's about it, really. But as to what we have finally in the end, you begin to reason about this or talk about this, he said, at once you fall into error, because we, once again, will begin to construct something there. People get so frustrated with these teachings because they keep wanting us to provide them with something that they can grasp. But nothing to grasp, nothing we can get hold of. So I'm amazed at all of you that will stick around here long enough, or myself too for that matter. Why? You know, why? But it's just that there was something in me that felt that there's something to this teaching, and it's different from anything else I had encountered. And everything else I encountered, it seemed like just so much BS, I'll just say. I mean, just nothing. I mean, all the different things that I would reach for. I mean, I had this strong yearning to get to the bottom of it all. Because underneath it all, I really, really wanted to know what the hell was going on here. And tried to make a life for myself, have some fun, do this and that, but it was always there, always there. And I despaired greatly in my youth. But I sensed early on, I encountered some of these teachings, and there was something here. And I can tell you now that, yeah, there is. But they're not going to hand it to you. It can't be handed to you. And that's the ordinary kind of stuff. And that's what was always wrong. I finally realized that later on. Well, that's why all these other things. I looked at different religions, different philosophies, and I pursued a number of different careers at one point. At least I thought I was going to try, give it a stab. Nothing. Because it was always somebody trying to supply you with something, as if this was going to be it. And somehow there was something different here. It wasn't trying to hand you something. Of course, I know it's cluttered with all kinds of belief and belief systems and ideas like that. And that used to puzzle me too. What? People believe this and they think that. And if you're a Buddhist, you got all. Well, here you have Wang Po. If you students of the way do not awake to this mind, he says, you will overlay mind with conceptual thoughts and you will seek Buddha outside yourselves and you will remain attached to forms, pious practices, and so on, all of which are harmful and not all the way to supreme knowledge. That's what we'll do. I mean, and he's saying he's cleaning the decks here. And that's what I sensed in these kinds of teachings. And I had never encountered anything like this before, because everything else was either to just keep you busy with your busy life and take care of that, and that's fine. Or what if you have a philosophical bent and you want to know what's going on here? Now you're probably turning to some deeper philosophies or religion. It's always going to try to sell you something. Well, this is the way. This is the thing you need to hang on to. This is the thing that will steady your boat, that sort of thing. Except for Buddhism, you encounter this sometimes. Of course, Buddhism, like I say, it's loaded with a lot of rituals and different kinds of things, and that's what Wang Po is warning them of here. All these pious practices and things. This isn't going to help you. But that's what I found so refreshing about this kind of teaching in this way. There's something different here going on. It wasn't about selling you a bill of goods or giving you something to hang on to and to bolster yourself and to make you feel safe. Because you're not going to feel safe. That's pounding nails in the door of the closet where your boogeyman is hiding. The only way you're going to be safe is to wake up. And that isn't about buying something. So we have to understand this too. And it pains me. I get accused of, selling a point or something. I realize that my teaching still isn't clear. I can't get this across, that there's nothing here to get across. This isn't about selling a point. This is about helping us to, just to wake up and to realize what this experience is and that we can't get hold of it. But he says, so it is what you see right before you. It is just this. It is immediate, direct experience. What you see, what you hear, all of that. And he says, begin to reason about it, begin to think about it. And what are we doing when we begin to reason about it and to think about it? Well, we're conceptualizing it. We're packaging it up. We're forming models, substitutes for reality. We're not appreciating or realizing or knowing or seeing reality itself directly. We're trying to get an idea of it. Our desire to get an idea of it is so strong, you got to recognize that and see what that is. And to realize that this is not what is needed. What is needed is just simply to see. And to realize what it is you're experiencing. And what do we notice about that? Well, you can't get hold of it. It is not nothing. You can't get hold of it. It doesn't belong to the categories of things that exist or do not exist. We don't have existence. That's what you can see. We don't have existence. We don't have non-existence. We don't have these things. These are extremes. The Buddha said, I teach a way by the middle to avoid these extremes. That is what we always have to come back to. But this is not some particular idea to grasp. Well, it is an idea. I suppose you can go ahead and grasp it. But that's not the point. It's to recognize this in actual experience. To recognize it yourself directly. These aren't just words. So begin to reason about it and immediately you fall into error. It is like the boundless void. Well, here's another problem word, void. Emptiness and void and nothingness are often, in the literature are often used interchangeably. Okay, just to get rid of any kind of idea of nothingness, that is not what Wang Po is talking about. He's not talking about nothingness. I can tell you that not because I'm an expert on Wang Po or anything like that, but because I know what Wang Po is talking about. I can see for myself what it is he's talking about, and he's not talking about nothingness. Okay, so just whenever if you encounter that word and you see some Buddhist Dharma teaching using that term, it's a bad translation. And I don't blame the I appreciate greatly the translators, but these are subtle points, and that isn't always understood. Very often it is not. The term void, too, also kind of gives this kind of impression, as if we're speaking of a kind of nothingness out there. And he also says the, here's even the word the, or the boundless void. Even that becomes a kind of a problem here. Because now it sounds like the boundless, let me say the boundless void, as if the boundless void were a thing once again. So when he's saying void, just simply meaning they're speaking in terms of shunyata, in terms of emptiness, that there's no particularness there at all. There's no substance to it. There's no selfhood. There's no permanence, no existence of anything residing within that. Okay? So since we don't have that, now we're speaking of it in terms of totality. There is the appearance, there's this continuous appearance of all of this stuff. You know, the sound and the color can seem to have solidity to it, all of that. And thought and feeling, the whole works. Okay? But in speaking of it in terms of boundless void, boundless emptiness, we're speaking of this, it's kind of like similar to Dogen using the term all beings. Just in totality, in this wholeness, there's actually nothing there. It's when all dharmas are without self, in effect. So it's very similar to that. In fact, I would say it's basically the same thing. Just want to stress that, because we're not talking now then about, and the way Dogen puts it is very good, like he says, when all dharmas are without self, as opposed to like the boundless voice. So Dogen hasn't really framed up as if we could frame up an object there. He's just saying, when all dharmas are without self. So we see all this multiplicity of stuff, but it's all without self. But it's also all dharmas. It's like this whole thing here. And that's what he's speaking of. And it's boundless. We don't find an edge to this. Why? Because this is reality. This is the one mind. This is the one mind without another. There's no edge to it. So it is boundless in that way. So that's what he's speaking of here then. But he says it is like the boundless void. Well, I would say it isn't that it's even like the boundless. That's what it is. It's when all dharmas are without self. But this one mind really is what we're speaking of. It cannot be fathomed or measured. Okay, so we can't measure its depth. Why can't we measure its depth? Well, because it doesn't have any depth. Of course, given our constantly leaping from one extreme to the other, if I say it doesn't have any depth, well, it's the same kind of problem going on. I don't mean that it has no depth, okay, but the language forces that to come out. It's not that it has no depth or that it has depth. It transcends this. This is why it can't be measured. You know, how big is reality? Well, it's a flat earth question. It's a meaningless question. It doesn't have any size. And this isn't even that far removed, as I just pointed out earlier. You look at a star, how far away is it? Well, depends on what you're referring to and what time frame you're going to take your measurement from and all that. In the end, ultimately, it's a meaningless question. That is reality. That is how it is. To us, we say, well, that's pretty abstract. Now, and actually, you know, the abstraction is that you think it's that distance, that time, that measured, framed out thing. There's the abstraction. The reality is, actually isn't that way at all. It isn't of that nature at all. This is reality. We don't get rid of the world that we can measure and take depths and soundings on and all of that. No, we work there and we can understand that to some degree. But if we're really interested in finding out and waking up to the nature of reality itself, that isn't going to help you whatsoever. In fact, it's going to keep you from it. It's going to block you. But we have to understand, though, that the nature of reality is such that, yeah, it's not to be fathomed or measured. And he says, the one mind alone is the Buddha. Okay, the one mind alone is the Buddha. Norm was kind of talking about this yesterday a bit. You know, this is not that Buddha who lived in India. Well, it is, I suppose, but it's not limited to that. This is this reality expressed as here in the human world as a human being. Okay, it is this one mind alone that is Buddha. And there is no distinction between Buddha and sentient things. Here it says sentient things, sentient beings. It is only that sentient being. So appreciate that too, that okay, so this reality that we've been speaking of here, that we can't really grasp, this is truly what Buddha is. But then he says that there's no distinction between Buddha and sentient beings, or Buddha and sentient things, at first he says. But he says it's just that sentient beings are attached to forms. Now here he's really laying it out for you, where the snake point is, where your problem is, because this is where it is. It is just that, what's the difference then between Buddhas and sentient beings? Ultimately, none. In reality, no difference at all. It's just that sentient beings, these particular Buddhas we'll call sentient beings, he says that they're attached to forms. And of course, one form being self. Mm-hmm. Self here, separate, apart from other than how we got time, just we've forgotten the fact that actually, ultimately, we don't have that. Ultimately, we don't. We really don't. But it looks that way, yeah. And now we're attached to that appearance. And we look out there now, feeling like, here I am, and I'm in need of something. I'm not a Buddha. I'm confused. I got pain and suffering in my life. I want to make myself comfortable and all of this. And so there's stuff out there. So I got to go out there seeking. And seeking, what, ultimate reality? The truth? This is what's going to resolve our confusion. But it isn't out there. When I say it isn't out there, then I don't mean it is in here. Because our language will, you know, every time you have to be listening for that too. When you hear something put like that, particularly in a negative, it doesn't mean we're leaping over to the other side now. It's just not that. It doesn't mean you have to go somewhere else. It's just not that. So it isn't out there. It isn't out there for you to get. You don't need to go seeking. It doesn't mean it's in here either, because there isn't any in here. The reason it isn't out there is not because it's not out there. The reason it's not out there is because there isn't any out there. That's the reason. You know? So that's why it can't be, well, then it's in here. As if in here was the opposite of out there. Well, it isn't. We don't have in here. We don't have out there. Shen Sang and the Xin Xing Ming. No inside, no outside, no in between, he says. And these guys aren't just talking to the wind. They're not sounding poetic. They're dropping hints, pointing all the time at reality, its true nature. Were we to see that, then we are spared a great deal of suffering and confusion. So the problem then between Buddhas and sentient beings is that sentient beings, they're attached to forms and they seek outwardly for Buddhahood. We go all searching out there for that which is immediately here. He says, before you, it's not even before you, it's just this right here, right from the very start. We don't need to seek externally. We don't need to seek internally, as Lee pointed out, in my book, in his class on Tuesday night, that this is about a journey into now. So it isn't a journey. We don't seek and go. It's right here, right now. So it's a journey that goes nowhere. It's not a journey, even. It's not a seeking. Okay, by their very seeking, they lose it. For that is using Buddha to seek for Buddha. If you want to realize Buddha, just realize Buddha now. Don't go seeking for Buddha. For people of this time and culture, it might have been a little bit more meaningful for us, even those of us who've been studying this way. But when they say seeking for Buddha, then they mean going out there and finding that which is going to do it for you. You know, finally, you know, but you find, could be, yeah, the right teacher, who's gonna save you and that sort of thing. Or the teaching or the way or whatever. That's what is meant by Buddha, the golden fish, we could say. You know, just seeking for that. So by their very seeking, they lose it, for that is using Buddha to seek for Buddha. Okay, so the very thing that you are seeking, it's right here, that's that image of the fellow who goes out searching for fire, so he takes his lamp, he's going out into the night, and so he takes his lamp, of course in those days it would be a lamp with a flame in it, and he's off searching, we would have a flashlight, that might not help you with your fire, you got to find your fire. He's carrying fire with him, and he's going out searching for fire. He doesn't understand. It's right here. And that's what we'll tend to do. So we sit here, we look at this, we're trying to figure it out, we're seeking. We're seeking even in these teachings. We're trying to get something from these teachings when all we need to notice is that this teaching is directing us back to just noticing this right here and nothing else. So by the very seeking, they lose it, and for that is using Buddha, to seek for Buddha, and using mind to grasp mind. And so we'll use our little conceptualizing mind, our own personal little ego mind, to grasp mind. The one mind, reality itself. You can't grasp it. You don't need to grasp it. You are experiencing nothing but that right now. And were we to sit down in nothing but Shikan, Taza, just being here present with it, we can see that. We can realize that directly, not through words or concepts, but just realize what it is that we experience directly. So even though they do their utmost in this seeking for a full eon, they will not be able to attain it. They do not know. No, they, of course, who are they? This is all of us. When we're confused on this issue, that's who he's talking about. So it could very well be you. So listen here. He says that they do not know that if they put a stop to conceptual thought and forget their anxiety, the Buddha, this would be reality, will appear before them. For this mind is the Buddha. This mind, this reality right here, is the Buddha, and the Buddha is all living beings. Are you left out of this arrangement here? No. So the Buddha will appear before them, for this mind is the Buddha, and the Buddha is all living beings. And it is not, and there's another point then just he throws in here at the end, that it is not less for being manifested as ordinary beings. It isn't like ordinary beings are now no good or inferior or bad-ish or just not up to snuff or what. You know, it's not that. It is not the less for being manifested in ordinary beings, nor is it greater for being manifested in the Buddhas. It's just reality itself. And to thinking any kind of thoughts of inferior or superior or Buddhas are better than ordinary beings or whatever. Ordinary beings, sentient beings, and Buddhas are nothing but the one mind, right from the very, very start. It is just that when we're confused, we'll make these comparisons. When we're confused, we, you know, splinter up the world, divide it up into this and that, self and other, and all the rest of it. And the point of this is that there's just simply no basis for that. You will not find, as Dogen said, we just looked at Genjo Kon, you continue like that and you'll find no path, no resting place. You won't find the way by doing this. It is just simply to recognize what it is that you're doing when you're off seeking. What are you doing at that point? You're distracted from noticing this. What is it to notice about this? That you can't get hold of it. It isn't something, you think you have something there. Yeah, maybe, it doesn't mean to dismiss it, no, it's useful, whatever. But it is, you'll never get hold of its nature. Its nature is such that you can't get hold of it. That's what its nature is. So you can't get hold of its nature. But it isn't nothing. So this is to bring us back to that, to notice. And so you notice yourself grasping, reaching. You're getting excited about something, you're getting worried about something, you're self-forming there. Getting angry, upset, anxious about learning about this. There it is. I mean, this stuff is abundant. It just keeps showing up. Notice it. What is going to come of that? What's behind the stuff of your concern there? Wang Po goes into this aspect of it in various places here in the book, too. But that's probably enough for today. But maybe... maybe we can address some of that tomorrow. I'll see. Well, I actually thought I'd go through two or three, four sections maybe, and barely got through one. In fact, I felt like I had to hurry up to squeeze that one in. But do I dare ask? Do you have any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.